Today and next week on Wings, you'll hear two Syrian women exiles who've remained deeply involved with their home country. In 2012, they talked with producer Kate Raphael about the extensive work of women organizers for peace and democracy, who risked their freedom and their lives to stand up to the Assad regime. When Assad fled to Russia December 8, 2024, Kate interviewed them again for Wings, the Women's International News Gathering Service. In lieu of our usual Wings sound logo, here's the sound of Syrian women celebrating in the streets.
The world was stunned on December 8, 2024, when Syrian President Bashar al-Assad left Syria, ending his family's half-century of totalitarian control. It was not only those outside Syria who failed to anticipate the collapse of the regime. Even those most directly involved in its defeat never believed that they were about to succeed. As they threw open the prison doors, releasing people who had been held for decades, Syrians struggled to comprehend what was happening. Here are some sounds from the liberation of women in the infamous Saydnaya prison, where tens of thousands were imprisoned during the last 13 years, and an estimated 30,000 prisoners were executed. How did this happen? To understand, I spoke to two Syrian women I interviewed 12 years ago at the beginning of the Syrian uprising, which was also a time of hope for Syrians living in exile. Dr. Afra Jalabi is an affiliate assistant professor at the Department of Cultures and Religions at Concordia University in Montreal. Her interests revolve around dialogue, comparative religion, and nonviolence. She was a weekly columnist in the Arab press for about 20 years. Mohija Kaf is a Syrian-born poet and novelist and professor of comparative literature and Middle East studies at the University of Arkansas on lands of the Osage and Quapaw nations. She's a winner of the Pushcart Prize for her writing and was honored in 2018 by the Democratic Black Caucus of Northwest Arkansas for lifetime achievement in inclusion in education. Today, I'll bring you the first part of my conversation with these two Syrian activists and commentators, and we will continue the discussion next week. The first part focuses on what has happened in the last 13 years. In the next episode, we'll focus on the prospects for the new government and what they hope to see as a transition to democracy. Can you just start by telling us a little about yourselves and how you'd like people to understand your position with regard to the Syrian revolution? Mohija, do you want to start?
Sure. I'm Mohija Qahif. I was born in Damascus and immigrated to this country with my parents when they were students in the early 70s and earned my own exile by the late 90s for writing about Syria, specifically in the context of Syrian literature and how it's never allowed to address the huge events of Syria, to the huge wounds of Syria. And in 2011, I began to try to amplify the voices of the nonviolent protesters in the Syrian uprising, you know, working with them on Facebook and Skype and writing, talking and so on with them and about them. And I've since published some studies of women's nonviolence campaigns in the Syrian uprising and I am also a poet, and I have a whole manuscript of poetry about Syria since 2011. It attempts to annotate almost through poetry the history of women's participation and uprising. I haven't been able to get it published because publishers are like, what is this? What is Syria? We see a few mother-daughter poems in here. Would you, want to make a mother-daughter manuscript out of it? It just doesn't register. Syria doesn't register.
Afra, do you want to tell us a little about yourself?
So I was born in Damascus. Then my family left when I was 5 to Germany. We were losing the Arabic language, so my parents would send us back and forth. And at some point, they moved to Saudi Arabia. And I did my high school there. My uncle is a well-known scholar among Syrians. He passed away 2 years ago. He was really interested in nonviolent reform of self and other. And so I grew up in a very nonviolent atmosphere in terms of theory and practice. My family is also from the Golan Heights, where we actually, the family homes are being returned after they've been either bombed or taken by the regime. Our own family home is standing, but totally tattered. So I thought that, like my dad said, it's a metaphor for the Syrian people. They're emerging from a 54-year-old brutal dictatorship. And so my connections to the Arab world, also being from the Golan, my grandmother's village is an Israeli settlement. And my own family have been in prison in out for many years. In fact, just a few days ago, we have a cousin who was taken by the regime authorities 43 years ago when his son, 1 year old. He's slowly becoming a symbolic figure for the prisoners. His name is Raghid Tatari. He is the cousin of my mother. And I remember I was in third grade when he disappeared. And for 10 years, we didn't know anything about him. And then my aunt and other family members found out which prison he was. And then many years later, they were able to finally see him. And there were some few like occasions where they could visit until one of our younger cousins was arrested for 3 years over like a couple of emails, and he ended up meeting him in Sidnaya. And now we're discovering, like, at some point, yes, maybe it was a prison compound, but in the last 13 years, it seems it had become a death camp. The stories are beyond shocking. So a lot of Syrians, our personal, like, when we talk about ourselves, we cannot talk about Syria without talking about detentions, disappearances, torture. We lost a lot of friends, some of them common friends between me and Muhja, to torture in the last 13 years. So it's a historic time for Syrians. The other day, I wrote a post that if you see people who are elated on cloud nine, even a few inches walking on air, a few inches above the ground, but their eyes are puffy from so much crying, you should know you're in the presence of Syrians.
I love that. And I'm speaking to you all from the West Bank in Palestine. And I think that what you're saying is equally true for Palestinians. Like, even when they're celebrating, there's so much pain.
And I'm very eager to talk about Palestine because that also is a struggle that is paramount in my heart. And really, I mean, I don't even know any Syrians for whom Palestine is not dear to their heart and the struggle paramount to their heart.
Let's turn to the events of last week. Most of us in the U.S. and Europe were completely shocked by the fall of the Assad regime. As you said, Moja, no one was paying attention to Syria for the last, at least 11 years. How surprised were you, and how do you interpret what has happened?
So in May, last May, I was talking to some activists who live in Gaziantep, and they had to, become refugees. And they were right there in the mix, protesting and then doing humanitarian work in the early years. So these folks are Syrian commies. But anyway, I was gathering news from them and others about the state of mind and the state of people inside Syria, and it was despair. It was such despair that I heard several cases that just absolutely chilled and broke my heart, that entire families were committing suicide. I mean, there was just no hope, no hope at all, no hope on the horizon, just 6 or 7 months ago.
My husband and I were reflecting on this with my dad and sisters yesterday, and I reminded my husband how, like the last few years, I was saying rationally, when after the Syrian revolution had been so brutally crushed, I was seeing no way out. I said, however, my faith in God and in this universe and in the way this universe is ordered upon justice, love, and compassion makes me feel that maybe one day we'll wake up and he will be gone. And then I remembered how Mohja, at the beginning of the revolution, had in one of her pieces, right, that there might be some Deus ex machina thing happen because of the amount of suffering that people lived through. But honestly, Kate, many Syrians around me, including myself, are saying we cannot deny the direct contribution of the innocent blood of Palestinians, especially women and children, in shifting the karma of the region and removing the brutal and violent militias, murderous militias of Hezbollah from the necks of Syrians, and pushing out Iran from the scene, which really created a vacuum around a murderous regime that relied on external powers, including Russia. The three major powers were Iran, Russia, and Hezbollah. Of course, there were other Iran-backed militias. And the amount of Syrian blood, the amount of Palestinian blood, is directly connected to the shift of certain karmic energies in this region for two evil entities to fall down, almost like the third retreating. When Nasrallah was killed, a lot of Syrians tried self-restraint. But the people in Idlib, like that liberated area, yes, they were distributing sweets, because when Israel would bomb certain areas in Syria, the Assad regime, Iran, and Hezbollah would consider the Syrian revolutionaries agents of Zionism. And instead of retaliating at those who hit them, they would go and bomb Idlib, the northwest of Syria. And they were bombing their own people. And so the events, in a way, were sudden and surprising. And I have a friend who's now like planning to go inside. He's been working with the coordinating councils, like in Syria, and he was telling me, he says, I can explain a lot of factors to you on the ground, but there was something also very divine about this, the shift of events, the way everything happened so fast. The Syrians found a historic moment, that this was a moment where Russia was really at a dire point in its war with Ukraine. Iran had retreated, Hezbollah completely hammered down, and Hezbollah had played a pivotal role in aiding the Assad regime. So I really, like a lot of my friends, family, we keep reminding ourselves almost daily that the blood of Palestinians has not been lost, and their celebrations and them distributing the sweets now in their turn and dancing in the streets and singing in under tents about the fall of the Assad regime shows, as Mohja said, the interconnected nature of our struggles in the region for democracy and also for freedom from occupation. Syrians were under an occupying dictatorship, aided by foreign powers, and the Palestinians are also under an occupation being aided by superpowers and nuclear powers.
On Wings, you're listening to contributing producer Kate Raphael, interviewing two Syrian women exiles who've remained deeply involved with their home country. They have strong opinions and a lot of information. Before the break, you heard Afra Jalabi, Now, here is Moja Kaf.
Okay, I have a lot to say. I don't know what to start with first. I think I would like to start with Palestinians and with talking to Palestinians. I want to say two basic things, love and abundance. To Palestinians as a Syrian, I want to say, I love you and you know it. We will continue loving you and your cause because it is righteous, released from their suffering under Assad. Syrians will figure out a way to support Palestine way more meaningful than some axis or some corridor. And what my friend Lana Barkawi, who is head of Misna Arab American Literary Journal, said immediately the first day to me was, the people are in solidarity with the people. And here, I mean, you know that I'm trying to address that tired and really horrible and dangerous delusion that Assad was about resistance to the Zionist entity in anything but rhetoric. If we ever did truly reach representative true democracy in Syria, that would represent a threat to the Zionist entity and to the U.S. So that, I mean, that's kind of one of the reasons for my pessimism and for, like, would they ever really let Syria reach a true state of democracy? And that's another thing, is that if we also really did reach, you know, a secular, sovereign, transparent, indivisible state that guarantees individual freedoms and that has an independent judiciary and rule of law, there would be in such a Syria a tolerance for Kurdish expression of the desire for autonomy and of the desire for maybe a future independent Kurdistan, for that to be discussed. And so Turkey will not really allow us to reach a democracy that could entertain that kind of tolerance. And so those are the reasons why I'm kind of a Dahlia Downer to Afra's optimism and hope. And I really think it's a bit much asking Syrians to hope, honestly, like after so much disappointment. I'll pause there because I then want to launch into, you know, the mix of feelings that this precipitated in me and in a lot of Syrians that I talked to that had this similar mix. When this operation was happening, you know, it did sweep us by surprise. First of all, the drive into Aleppo, we thought would, okay, this, you know, Alayustor is what my Aleppan friends were saying. You know, this is going to precipitate a whole regime attack on Aleppo. Civilians are going to get bombed again. And indeed, the regime did attack and cruelly shell civilians in Idlib in retaliation immediately. But as it swept further and further, you know what? Honestly, there was also a deep anger that I felt, and a very gendered anger. And I just felt like all of it, this was started by women. Women organized. Women have did so much to lead the 481 local coordinating councils, major, huge swaths of them were led and organized by women, by activists, by nonviolent people whose vision was of a civil, secular state that respected all individual rights and liberties of all genders, I might say also. Do you know that Syrian queer people were part of those protests, were in some cases key parts of those nonviolent protests? And then for this to all just be swept away, and now everyone, you know, in Syria heroizing this last gasp of the sort of distorted side of the revolution as the heroes, as the liberators. No. And for there to be this huge wave of amnesia about how all of this was really made possible by, as Afra said, by the those who've gone before, And the fear that they may not be remembered in this, all of this is sort of churning and cycling in me as I also go to like this sense of surreal elation that Assad is gone from Syria. Do you know, this is a minor little tiny point, but I made a vow in 2012 never to cut my hair until Assad was gone from Syria. And honestly, somewhere along the line, you know, by the late teens, I guess, I just figured that I was just going to go to the end of my life, never going to a salon again or cut, you know, getting a haircut. I there was a phase where my hair started to drop and shorten from excessive swimming and the chlorine and stuff. And it was like, what is the universe trying to tell me here? You know, and I did experience that moment of elation when I did cut my hair in front of Palestinian friends and Palestinian witnesses last Sunday. But then I cycled back around to this, you know, these people that are greeting them as heroes. Do they also know that people were dying during those very same days up in northeast Syria as the Turkish-backed SNA was battling the, you know, US-backed Kurdish forces there? Three women were killed in Membij, even the day after the ceasefire was made in Membij. Qamar, Aisha, Iman. You know, and there's also mourning happening. 214 or so people fell in those fights where Syrians are killing Syrians. And then I cycle back at the same time. We cannot help but also have that feeling of euphoria for a minute, you know, even though we know where we know by now, right? We've seen the Egyptians, we've seen so many other examples. We know it can only be a fleeting moment, but it is there in the mix.
Afra, I read something you said in another interview that the Syrian civil war, quote, became a proxy war inside Syria, where 47 countries bombed Syria at different points in different situations and contexts. And I was like, 47 countries? I mean, I knew the US, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, but 47
Israel.
countries, and of course Israel, which is continuing to bomb,
Well, including
even.
Canada, because, you know, at some point there was an international coalition to defeat ISIS, which suddenly appeared in the middle of the Syrians struggling for their own liberation. And in fact, many people don't know that the regime didn't fight ISIS, so which looked really suspicious to Syrians. And a lot of the defeat of ISIS was in many instances of confrontation was done by the Free Syrian Army. The Syrians were at some point were fighting Hezbollah regime forces, Iran, and ISIS at the same time, and sometimes fighting amongst each other because they were splintering. And even if you look at Jolani's history, it captures this evolution of armed resistance in the region being anti-imperialist and then slowly becoming kind of organic and localized, and Jolani himself saying, I no longer belong to a global jihadi movement. I am Syrian. I come back to create my own revolution here, and which upset Al-Qaeda leaders, and there were assassination attempts on him, and then he had to get rid of Al-Qaeda supporters, and he is fairly a shrewd man, and he's a survivor.
Sorry, I just want to interrupt to clarify for our listeners that when you talk about the liberators, you're talking about the organization called Hayat Tahrir al-Shams, or known in the West as HTS. You
It's
mentioned
all at this point.
Jolani, that's Ahmed Hussein al-Sharaa, whose nom de guerre was Abu Muhammad al-Jolani.
Slightly out of date to be using Hayat Tahrir al-Sham and HTS, as I understand it. So-called, supposedly, they now are just saying that's not a thing anymore. It's just the Salvation Government, Hukumat al-Inqilab.
And they said that after they liberate Syria, they will dissolve themselves and they will try to reorganize themselves into a national Syrian army.
Or they say.
Well, we'll see, we'll see. But for me, what I see is that what's happening, because I saw a lot of lefties saying that this is a CIA operated takeover of Syria. Turkey is
Yes,
colonizing
you and I
Syria.
agree that that is not the case and that that is
Yeah,
preposterous.
yes. And I still want to also roll back a little bit.
Afra now looks back at some of the violent elements of the Syrian revolution. She will mention Hezbollah, which is a faction within Lebanon that also recruited and engaged in Syria.
What happened in the last 13 years? Yes, it started as a very nonviolent, peaceful revolution, almost spearheaded by women and university students. So when the peaceful the revolution was happening, the Syrians were met with brutal repression, snipers, tanks, and some bombing started. And so they couldn't protest. So a lot of Syrian soldiers started defecting from the army, even from security forces. And they were saying things that are like an oxymoron to somebody like me who's invested in nonviolent theory and practice. They were saying we will protect the nonviolence of the revolution by violent means, because they weren't aware of the dynamics of introducing elements of armed resistance into a peaceful revolution. But there were also a lot of losses. 5,000 civilians were sniped or killed. So they started forming militias and asking civilian young men to join them. So they started forming what is called like the Free Syrian Army, and there were various groups and various orientations. So then Hezbollah, actually, the Syrians know Hezbollah is not strong because kids in t-shirts and running shoes defeated Hezbollah. And then in 2014, the Iranian regime actually fully invaded Syria to support Assad because Hezbollah couldn't finish the job. And in 2015, 14 and 15, almost 70% of Syria was in the hands of rebels, and Iran was not able to finish the job. So Iran went to Russia and asked for the aid of Russia to come and start aerial bombardment of entire cities, the way they actually ended up doing it in Ukraine, which is why the Ukrainians, for example, have a special kind of connection to the Syrian cause, because they feel the defeat of Syrian civilians, especially the grassroots areas that supported the rebels. Putin was basically, as a consequence, emboldened to invade Ukraine after what he accomplished for Assad in Syria.
I'm Kate Raphael with Syrian-born feminist activists and scholars Afra Jalabi and Mohoja Kahaf. Dr. Afra Jalabi is affiliate assistant professor at Concordia University in Montreal and one of the founders of the Day After Project, which convened early in the Syrian revolution to envision a democratic future for Syria. Mohoja Kahaf is a poet and novelist and professor at the University of Arkansas. The discussion took place over Zoom on December 15th, 1 week after the Syrian government fell.
That concludes part one of Kate Raphael's interview. Next week in part two, the guests discuss their analyses, hopes, worries, and intentions for the future of their diverse and complex mother country, Syria. You'll find links to our archives through the website wings.org. Wings thanks all our supporters, including your local community radio stations, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughan, whose recent events can be viewed on the website maternalgifteconomymovement.org. That's all one word, maternalgifteconomymovement.org. I'm Wing's series producer, Frieda Worden, and this is the Women's International News Gathering Service.